For the past 15 years, the environmentalist Paul Hawken has gone around the country giving talks about sustainability and ecological development. After each talk, a few people would come up and tell him what they were doing on a local level to try to bring about some change. He began to wonder just how many groups and organizations there are out there involved in progressive causes. So he set about counting. It took a long time, because it turns out there are an astonishing 1 to 2 million organizations worldwide working on social justice and environmental sustainability. Hawken calls it the invisible revolution, and he writes about it in a book called Blessed Unrest, how the largest movement in the world came into being and why no one saw it coming. And Strange Chimps wanted to know who the people in this movement are.
Oh, there's schoolchildren and nuns and ecofeminists and engineers without borders and doctors without borders, and, you know, they're grieving Muslims and grieving Christians and grieving Buddhists, and, you know, they're farmers and poets, they're fisher people, they're everyone in the world, in every culture, every language, every city. This movement is everywhere in the world without exception.
And the subtitle of your book is Why No One Saw It Coming. How is it possible that a genuinely widespread social movement like this could form completely under the radar?
Because we're looking the wrong way. We're looking for the charismatic male vertebrate to to save us, or female vertebrate. We are not prepared to see a movement organizing itself from the bottom up that's really self-organizing and depends on networking and collaboration as opposed to centrality. And that is what we don't see. We hear about a spokesperson from NRDC or Sierra Club, but we don't understand when it comes to water conservation, water quality, water itself. There's over 9,000 organizations in the world that are addressing water issues. There's 600 different organizations that are addressing corruption and transparency with respect to business and political practices. I mean, there are 12,000 organizations that are addressing human rights in the world that we have in our database, and our database is probably 10% of the total number of organizations.
How powerful do you think it could be? I guess I'm wondering, how powerful can a piecemeal movement be that doesn't have a central unifying purpose or a, you know, coherent leadership structure?
Well, one of the reasons I call it a movement is because if you take those value statements and the goals and of those organizations, and if you could just write them down, you know, the 8 points, the 7 points, whatever they are, and you could put them on a piece of paper and you put them on a wall in a big, 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 big room, one after another. Remember, there's over a million of these. And you read them, what you would find that each of them is different, but they don't contradict each other. And the uniqueness of that arising is really unprecedented in the world. That has simply never happened before. I use literally this analogy of the immunity, of the immune system, as a way to describe, because the immune system is the most complex system in the human body by far. But the strength of the immune system is due to its connectivity, not to its centrality. And it brings down governments. It brings corporations to its knees. It changes law. It changes policy.
Why do you think this is happening? I mean, you use the analogy of the immune system, which is an interesting one to use because it sort of suggests that it's almost an automatically occurring kind of function of the larger organism, which is the planet.
You know, and I think it's true. I mean, I looked for how this unnamed movement was structured, how it was organized, its roots, its history. I read voluminously about prior social movements. And as I said, I couldn't find the words, the descriptions, the language that actually adequately describe what it is that I've experienced, what I know, and what I've studied and researched. And so therefore, I turned to biological metaphors because they actually did begin to describe humanity as sort of organismics, as an organism. And this has been Lewis Thomas. Many scientists and philosophers have described humanity possibly as a single organism, acting in ways that are beyond the ken of, say, one person or one small group of people. And I actually do think that, in fact, humanity is acting in its best interests. And I think it's like the immune system itself. There's parts of it that are extraordinarily mysterious. We do not know, for example, when you get very, very sick, by all rights, technically, the immune system should fail. And the great immunologists will tell you that at that point, we should just go to heck in a handbasket, and we do not.
You know, you're sort of getting close to using language that somebody might see as spiritual. You know, there's a quality to what you're talking about that other people might call grace. Do you see there being a religious or spiritual component to this kind of movement?
I do. When I was tracing back the history of this movement, I went to the Transcendentalists, and then it goes to the abolitionists, Clarkson and Wilberforce in the 1780s and 90s in London. But what's interesting about the abolitionists was that it was the first time a group of human beings got together to organize themselves on behalf of people who were suffering that they did not know, would never know, and for whom there would be no direct or indirect benefit to themselves. And now we take that for granted, that school children and people and organizations and NGOs do that all the time. But that was the first time it happened. Well, why were those Quakers doing it? The concept of a charity, of the charities themselves, really goes back, and if you pull the string on that flower bag, it goes back to the Axial Age, to the birth of religiosity in the West and the East, to the Buddha, to Mencius, to Lao Tzu, to Socrates, to Jeremiah, to Isaiah. And when you look at that period of time, it was a time of great barbarity, cruelty, and violence. There was a lot of unrest in the world in those areas. And what happened is sages and philosophers and leaders sort of said, what does it mean to lead a moral and ethical life? And what they came up with almost simultaneously without discourse with each other was two concepts. And one was the golden rule, which is never, ever do anything to anyone you wouldn't have done to yourself. And the second, and the basis of that, was that all life was sacred, whether it's a child or a creature or a culture. And if you look at this movement, in a sense, it's not a religious movement at all. But if you look at the core values of this movement, it is the golden rule and that life is sacred. So therefore, what activity do you do? What is a moral and ethical life? People are waking up and making decisions to give up sometimes very lucrative jobs, sometimes they don't have jobs at all, sometimes they go from school with good degrees and go into this work because this work, I think, is the most fulfilling and meaningful work there is.
Paul Hawken, talking with Anne Strangechamps about his new book, Blessed Unrest.